Four men. Four men. Masters in their fields. Coming together to pontificate on science and technology. These great men, dedicated to truth, honor, and justice in the American way, are the Gizmo Sisters.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 115. With me today is Matt and actually my other half, Molly. And we're sitting at the IKEA in Cincinnati having a little bit of dinner and thought we'd put out a podcast. We haven't put one out because everybody's been so busy. And frankly, the news cycle hasn't been... We're not like CNN. We actually will not repeat things or try not to repeat things. The news cycle hasn't been that great, either on the technology side or the political side or anything else. We finally have, I think, enough new stuff to kind of talk about that, it might actually be interesting. I want to start off with, Apple had their Worldwide Developers Conference a couple weeks ago, and they announced a slew of new hardware and all of that's available, and it is cool stuff, and I do, There's some things that I want to have and hold and call my own. But the thing is that new hardware was not the start of the show. The thing that was innovative and is the game changer was what the Worldwide Developers Conference is about, and that's the software. And one of the things that was really, really striking was... the improvements in both the next version of macOS 10, which they're calling High Sierra, and then iOS 11. And the thing is you take them each separately and they have some great improvements. You put them together because it's an ecosystem. Your phone, your tablet, your laptop. And as an ecosystem, what they can do together is amazing. And Apple did a lot of really cool things, particularly on the macOS 10 side, to really differentiate what would be laptop and desktop hardware versus what they kind of consider the other mobile platforms. And, over Thunderbolt 3 the USB-C port on the new devices, you can run an external graphics card, which takes the whole idea of a portable workstation to a totally different level. Because we're getting to the point in computing where, for the majority of people, they don't need laptops even anymore. It's people who, like me, who are content creators, who need the ability to drive, external cameras and external video cards and external audio sources and things like that, that you really need a laptop. And if you look at what they updated in the hardware, they updated the MacBook Pro, they updated the iMac, and they updated the MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook, which was a professional model machine with a Retina display that can do 4K video. But they didn't update what everybody wanted them to update, which was that MacBook Air. And why was that? Well, if you look at iOS 11, they made it more, in some respects, they made it more macOS 10-like, but still touchscreen driven and pen input driven. But it's really the Mac, and they updated that to a 10.5-inch, there's no 9.7-inch or iPad mini anymore, but the iPad Pro, you have a 10.5-inch and a 12.9. Why? Because those are the new MacBook Airs, where people who need limited connectivity, but they need, be able to do document creation, do some content creation. And one of that is they put a dock on it, which a lot of people want. I want to put my favorite applications in the dock, whereas before the dock on iOS on the iPad, you could put four apps, Now you can put as many as you want. It gets a little cluttered if you have too many. The other thing they did that I thought was a big improvement was macOS 10 is, and we're going to segue into something else about this, is very secure. But it's very secure because it's based on Unix. And Unix has a totally different security model if done correctly. But when they went to, since the underpinnings of macOS 10 and the underpinnings of iOS are the same, when they went to iOS, they wanted to make it, as a mobile device, even more secure. They didn't want to have this concept of, okay, you know, opening things up to where you could get more malware, you could get viruses, that type of thing. And we've seen that already. Windows 10 phones have had it. Android phones have had it. There haven't been too many malware. Usually it's just a malware app where the app itself would collect information and because you entered it, not because it was pulling it from other things. That's social engineering is something totally different than a malicious application in that respect. But they created this because the applications were what we call jailed, or they can't. One application can't see the data of another application or anything else, it caused kind of problems. Like if I wanted to pull I'm creating a document in PowerPoint for the iPad, and I want to pull a graphic, it was kind of difficult. I had to, you know, give explicit permission to use my Photos app, or if it was an application or a photo that I had somewhere else, in another app that I edited, say I edited Photoshop, I couldn't pull it from Photoshop without some interim step in there. And so they created this thing called Files. And Files now gives a local space to store your documents, as well as all your cloud storage, iCloud, OneDrive, Google Drive, so you have access and can move data around fairly easily and still use all your apps with that. Now, the apps have to be updated to access Files, but with the public beta that's out, you can actually use, you know, Apple's Office Suite with it, and it works great. But where that's a paradigm shift is where the tablet in the past has been, or the iPad in the past has been a what they call a second screen, you know, providing casual browsing and all such stuff. Now it's more of a truly replacement for these ultra portable business type laptops, and Android's tried to play in that space a little bit too. But what's kind of weird is, Android's almost disappeared from the tablet market because they became part of it. Is the issue with how they update the software? You know, it's low end hardware. They're putting the software on it. Companies like Samsung. They're like, I'm not going to put the effort in to update the software so you get the latest version with all the security patches. So they've kind of become throwaway devices, and people got tired of that because who wants to drop $200 to $400 on an Android tablet every time they need to update that device? And I don't think there was enough integration between – well, there is no integration. You would think that with the Chromebook and Android that there would be integration – so that you'd have more of an ecosystem like you do with the iPad and the Mac desktops, laptops, and your iPhone, to where, you know, like, I go to my Wi-Fi menu on my Mac or my iPad, and it'll find my phone via Bluetooth securely, and I can turn on the mobile hotspot, you know, so I have internet access. None of that, you don't have that kind of integration. Which always kind of shocked me, particularly with Google. The other thing I think Google's kind of got left their eyes not on the ball anymore with Android, because they want to hit the education market where they're making money with Chromebooks. And so what is the biggest thing that's happened to Chromebooks? Android apps can now run on Chromebooks. So now you get Microsoft Office for Android now runs on this other device, but this device isn't an Android device. You know, so you're kind of going, scratching your head going, well, if that's the case, why do I need a tablet? I'll just get the Chromebook. And a lot of the new Chromebooks have touch screens. You know, it's kind of interesting, you know, what's happening in the marketplace. And Windows went all in, but it's still Windows. So, and I think this might... be more interesting is, you know, Microsoft created Windows S. They released their new Surface Book, which is like essentially their version of the MacBook Air. And it is touchscreen, but it runs as Microsoft Windows 10-S, which you can upgrade to the, you know, the Pro version and everything else. But the S version doesn't allow you to have access to the command line directly. It does not, you could only load apps from the App Store. You know, so they're trying to make it more secure. And what's been great is all these security guys who come in and go, well, it's still Windows, watch this, you know? And they've sideloaded malware, you know, and there, it hasn't taken, it's taken a little more effort, but not much more effort. Not enough to, it's not so much effort that it would stop people from exploiting it. And then, you know, how about these issues? What is it, 65,000 devices across the globe in major government and business centers? Siemens kills me. Siemens, who sells devices, SCADA devices and other things, has now been attacked by not only the WannaCry, but now the new Petra or Petra, whatever it's called, malware. And so you just have to sit there and scratch your head and go, you know, if I'm going to run these enterprise applications on this, why are we still seeing some of these issues? Comments? Peanut gallery? Come on.
I don't know. I mean, your analysis has been pretty spot on. I haven't really felt like I needed to chime in and dumb the whole program down. You've managed to hit all of those topics with.
I've actually been, because we've had time, I've really thought about this a lot, and I'm like, you know, and a lot of this is related to how I now view the world through my new job, since I'm a chief technical officer. So I'm looking kind of more forward thinking, what are companies doing this? What are they thinking about? And Microsoft is a head scratcher. As much as they want to, you know, and it's kind of the whole fake news thing, the Democrats and the Republicans and the whole fake news, and you read the news and everybody, you know, all these tech people are like Microsoft, you know, tech writers and stuff. The new Surface Book is phenomenal and this and that, and then, you know, you start reading the real news and it's like, well, you know, we can break Windows 10S real easily by using Word macros because they didn't protect against that. By the way, there's still admin accounts that, you know, have passwords that the applications call immediately to do this, that, or the other. So I just think it's humorous. The other fact that I'm a little concerned about is that 32 terabytes, not 32 gigabytes, not 32 megabytes, 32 terabytes of Windows 10 source code was released in the wild. So what is that, you know, give it 6 months and these real hacker groups are going to find every exploit that they can find that hasn't been patched. Because it won't be hard to test to see if it was patched or not. You know, you take a patched machine and you go, well, let's see if this one works, you know. It's just an untenable security model. Microsoft is going to have to do what Apple did, and they're going to have to either get out of the just desktop operating business, which they're not good at, or they're going to have to rewrite it from scratch and get rid of a lot of fundamental problems that they.
Do you know why they still do it?
It's easy, and it would the cost of doing it is so great that they don't want to do it. And they're not the only company who does that. I know enterprise companies who they leave all this legacy crap in their products because to get rid of it and actually do it right is more effort than they're willing to put into it. They don't find any value in it.
Yeah, but the reason why they still do it is there are people like me. I'm 12 days out from a new job. Headquarters sent me an email asking me, do I want a PC-based laptop or do I want a Mac laptop? And what did I say?
Oh, you said PC-based.
Yeah. Because that's what I've...
What you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to go into a, you know, I'm in the midst of a major career change. The last thing I want to do is fight a new computer, you know, so... And I can't be alone there. I know there's got to be a whole... slice of the market that's
but
that's
even the,
think.
The funny thing is though is the gooey part that everybody's familiar with is not the insecure part. It's not the part that we need to change. It's the underlying, you know, a good example is Microsoft, and this is something they did back in Windows 1.0. Back when we had limited memory and people were saying 640K of memory was great and we'd never need more than that. And I'm looking at my machines at home going, you know, 48 gigabytes of memory is not enough. I still get issues. And, but, you know, they wrote, they're essentially their driver database and their settings database is a flat file, a single file that just has a whole bunch of entries in it and it gets bigger and bigger and they load it in memory because that's how the operating system works. That has not changed since Windows 1.0. That needs to go away because that's half their problem. Because if all your settings were in one file, I only need to access that one file and I can start messing with stuff. I can inject drivers. I can inject applications that start at launch. I can change permissions on things so I can do other stuff. You know, and I can do things like encrypt all your data using the using Microsoft's own encryption engine, but you can't get to it. And neither Microsoft can't get to it either. You know, it's just, it's a bad security model. Every service and every driver should be, you know, do what all other modern operating systems do that are not Windows-based, and that is they jail those processes so that if one process gets compromised, it doesn't compromise everything on the system. And it's not to say, I mean, there's bugs in all code, so it's not to say that, you know, all these other operating systems are perfect and there's not exploits that can be taken advantage of. But there's not so many simple exploits to be taken advantage of. You know, and when you look at viruses and malware and worms and that type of thing, they're not targeting the real operating systems that that are either real-time or Unix-based.
Because they don't need to.
Well, yeah, because Windows will get you access to the data you want.
Well, sure. And honestly, if I'm you, Mr. Magboy, I would be celebrating that.
Oh, I am to some degree, but you know, I do come from a IT security background, and I kind of want it fixed. Okay, we'll move off my soapbox there for a minute. Something that Matt probably will have a little bit more input on. First of all, I want to talk about Amazon buying Whole Foods.
Why?
I said the same thing.
I don't get it.
It's akin, so it's kind of, here's what I think, really what it is, because you have the CEO of Walmart, you have Jeff Bezos at Amazon, and Walmart bought Jet.com, which was Amazon's only competitor. And I mean, you're talking about a company who has a fraction of the market share that Amazon does, and doesn't have nearly the vendor relationships, does not have nearly the supply chain. I mean, think about it. Amazon's building their own transport company, jet transport company, so they don't have to rely on UPS. Okay?
And that's not only really until they can get the drone fleet approved.
Yeah. And so I actually think it's a urinary distance competition that Amazon, who is, or Walmart, who is a big competitor of Amazon, but in a brick and mortar, they bought into the online retail space, and so he wants to get back at Amazon by buying Whole Foods because, or not get back at Amazon, get back at Walmart for buying Whole Foods because now he's attacking Walmart's How? Because...
Seriously, look at the demographics of people who go to Whole Foods and compare that to the demographic that shops at Walmart.
Oh, I totally get you.
Setting foot in Whole Foods.
Well, the funny thing is I'm reading the analyst information on it, and I'm sitting there going, okay. The analysts are all like, well, you know, Amazon or Whole Foods, they're both innovative in their markets and all this other stuff. And I'm thinking, Whole Foods, if you just read the, they put out the top 100 grocery store chains in the nation, and Whole Foods ranked near the bottom, you know, for both customer service and all this other stuff. And I'm like, you know, Amazon's all about customer service. Like, if you have a problem and you actually call them, they tell you, okay, we'll send a new one out tomorrow, you know,
exactly.
and it's done. And that's not the same model. The other problem is Whole Foods' business model is to cater to that upper middle class vegan. I mean, don't get me wrong; they have some good stuff there. I'll tell you, the Whole Foods near us has one of the best beer selections I've ever seen, and I'm trying to figure that one out. It's almost as good as Jungle Jim's.
Wow, that's impressive.
And theirs is all refrigerated. Ooh. That's why I like going in there, because you can go get a cold six pack.
Okay.
And but you know, you sit there and their bakery is really, really good. Okay, baked goods are not something Amazon's going to be good with. But the only thing I can they talk about this whole Amazon buying Whole Foods is going to change how you buy food.
Yes.
Now,
I
think that was going to.
Whoever's even saying that is crazy.
I think, yeah, I agree too. I think that's a much harder leap to make in assumption, because the things you go to a brick and mortar grocery store for are the perishable items: milk, bread, meat, vegetables, you know, fruit, cheese. I don't see Amazon, you know, changing that model too much. The only thing I can figure out that what might change the model is you order online. So there have been some companies like, have you heard of Peapod? We never had Peapod here in Cincinnati, but we did have it in Columbus and D.C. and other areas where I've been. And you get online and Peapod, you would tell them what you want. You make a grocery list. A lot of times it was all your perishable items usually, or stuff that you routinely use, and they would deliver it like every week, every 2 weeks, whatever you wanted it to your house, and they automatically charged your card and just got delivered. And it was the idea was that in big cities, they were delivering high quality food because they actually had people who really knew how to pick produce and fruit. And you know, the convenience is that you don't have time to go out. And I actually had a colleague who was worked full-time, and her husband worked full-time, and they had two younger kids, and she used Peapod. That's how they got their groceries, you know, and she had the app on her phone, and, you know, we need to add this, and, you know, they would get it, so that way she didn't have to spend time going out. That being said, Peapod didn't scale well, because the only places where Peapod worked were in big cities, and I don't think the business model has worked for them. It's almost like Uber. Uber works great in big cities, but as they tried to scale out and make it more ubiquitous, Uber didn't work out real well.
Well, and that's why you see Uber pushing driverless cars.
Yes.
I think once they do that, then you could conceivably do it nationwide.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the only model I can think of why they're getting concerned about it, because regional grocery store chains, so like Dorothy Lane Market, they do that today. You go online, you can order, but you have to go pick it up. And there's been a lot of talk from both Target, since Target is now becoming a grocery store chain. They've remodeled most of their stores with whole grocery sections.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I went into a Target the other day and there was like a third of the store is now a grocery store. And I was like, when did this happen?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, you have Targets. Walmart has been talking about the whole order your groceries online and they will deliver them to you. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the whole idea that as a Walmart employee that, you know, if you wanted to do it off work, you know, off your normal time in the store work, that they would pay for you to, you know, as you're leaving the store, take a couple of orders and deliver them locally.
Wow.
And I think that's what Amazon is afraid of. Because once you get there, then it's every store becomes, no matter what it is, whether it's groceries or it's dry goods or home goods or whatever, if you can get local delivery, like, because, you know, the thing about Target and Walmart, and I almost hate shopping at them, because when you, if you go into like a standard grocery store like a Kroger's, but even Kroger's marketplaces are becoming more like Target and Walmart, but you go into like a Kroger's or a Smith's or Harris Teeter. They're traditional grocery stores. They pretty much carry grocery items, a little bit of cookware, and you're done. And you go in, you get your groceries, you go home. And when you go to Walmart, you go into Walmart, get your groceries, and you start looking around. And, hey, that's really cool in electronics. I'll get one of those. And, hey, the kids want some toys. There's toys in the toy aisle. And, oh, we need some new pillows for the bed. And all of a sudden, you know, the $50 grocery run became a $300
excursion.
Exactly. And
I wouldn't know anything about that.
That's what Target and Walmart live off of. And I think that's what Amazon's afraid of, because they're just the online version of that excursion, but they don't have the draw to go in the store. So if all of a sudden Target and Walmart and other store companies like Myers Corporation, I mean, there got to be a few others who are thinking about this too. If they aren't, they're being stupid. Who are going, well, you know, if I can get local delivery as opposed to waiting 2 days on Prime, you can have it on your doorstep tomorrow. And we have it in stock at the store. You know,
there's really two approaches for the brick and mortar stores to really survive. One is, instead of having checkout people, they have delivery people.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting approach. I'd like to see how that works out.
So the only thing I have, and this is looking at it totally from a business perspective, is what is the liability of delivery drivers? You know,
that's where the drone fleet comes in.
Yeah, very true.
There will be no liability.
Well, that's not totally true.
I welcome our robot overlords. I'm just putting it out there, just, you know, covering my bases.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other thing, and this is something that Sam's Club is doing, and I'd like to see them do this for Walmart eventually, is they now have where you can scan your items with your phone, and it's connected to your card, and if you get to the end, you click, pay it, and it pays it, spits out a receipt that they check, and you're out the door. That's one employee that you need at the store. That's all you need.
Well, you know, and that kind of segues into the whole...
Because for me, the thing that aggravates me the most about going to the grocery store, or any store really in general, is having to wait and looking and seeing 50 checkout lines with two employees and a line to the next counter.
Well, it's funny. Back when Sam Walton was still alive, Walmart's policy was if there were three people in a line, a new line was open. You know, and that definitely has gone the way of the dodo. And I agree with you. I do not understand, just from a business perspective, I don't understand why there's so many checkouts at, like, Walmart, or Target for that matter, because they never have, even at the Christmas rush, they never have more than three open. They never have more than three open. Now, our Walmart luckily has self-checkout, so does our Kroger's, and I use those liberally because I love them. But that being said, they're not good for large orders and stuff. You know, it's just get in, get out with a couple things. And
see, the problem you have with that at Walmart is you have to have the sign up that says 10 is this many.
Yeah.
You know, and that gets aggravating too. But then again, where are these people going to go? Because that's the only line that's open.
Exactly.
So, I don't know. I mean, I don't think brick and mortar still got it all figured out.
Oh, I don't either. But the thing is, you know, because we complain about this a lot, is, you know, why isn't there more food delivery? You know?
Yeah, I'm talking about restaurants, too, you know? Like,
yeah. Well, and that was interesting. I read an article about this, and I thought it was interesting. It was an analyst article, and they were talking about restaurants. And we've talked about this in the past. I have this fascination with the history of department stores. I don't know why it's interesting to me, but you know the idea of the department store, and I'm not talking like, you know, in the United States. I'm talking like I'm interested in. I've read all about Selfridge and what he did in England and you know how it all developed and how it's kind of all falling apart at the same time and then the rise and fall of what they call discount stores and super discount stores, and I mean. But the restaurants are the same way. There's this whole concept of... I used to think there was sit-down restaurants and fast food, but now there's this whole idea of casual dining. And then there's a whole idea of super casual dining. So I guess there's a difference between TGI Fridays and Panera. And the difference is, because Panera's not considered fast food. I always considered that fast food. You stand in line, you can either eat it there or you can take it to go.
It is like a little,
you know? But evidently, that's called super casual dining. And casual dining is like TGI Fridays, you know, Bennigan's, that kind of thing where you, O'Charlie's, where you go in and they actually seat you and you sit down and have a meal, as opposed to fine dining where you would go and have a multi-course dinner and all this other stuff. But a lot of the restaurant chains that fit into that casual dining, the TGI Fridays, where you get seated and you sit down and have a meal, they're all shuttering stores. They're, you know, racking up massive losses. Applebee's is one of the big ones. And they
Applebee's is horrible.
Yeah, it could be that it could be better. That being said, my nephew's a manager at he's like a regional manager at Applebee's. And,
man, fix it.
Yeah, well, I that's what his job is. But
do better. Yeah. Faster, please. Yeah.
But the analysts are all saying the reason people, that the current millennials and even people of our age, they don't want to go and sit down at the restaurant. They want to get food that they can take home and eat at home. They're not. It's not that they're not dining out as often as they were. It's that they're not staying to eat it at the restaurant.
Now, I saw an article today. I didn't actually read it, but I saw it. Olive Garden is actually saying that millennials are saving them, which I don't get because that's the only restaurant that's saying that.
It was not the... I thought I had it in my notes, the article I was looking at. I don't see it though. I'll find it and I'll put it in the show notes because it was very interesting what they were saying about how all of this was working. And they cited real numbers, which when you start citing real numbers, that has a ring of truth to it. And
you're not getting fake news there.
Yeah. So, but the other thing that's happened too is fast food restaurants are becoming more casual dining places. Like McDonald's has made a huge investment and effort to up the game on their food with the Signature Series. They've changed the decor in all of their restaurants so that, you know, because the whole idea of fast food restaurants having these brightly lit places and all this stuff was all wrapped around the idea that people would leave faster because it was garish color and all this other stuff. And now, you know, McDonald's wants you to hang out and drink coffee, and so they, you know, they've made everything earth tones, and they've softened the light, and, you know, it's kind of a dramatic, particularly when you see an old McDonald's, particularly a private franchise, that because they're not under mandate to change that, versus a corporate-owned store. And all the corporate-owned stores, they look like Starbucks on the inside, except they're serving Big Macs.
Fries still suck.
Yeah.
Just saying.
So, speaking of McDonald's, this will be the last topic we'll cover this time, because I've got 1,000 other topics we can go off on. The whole $15 wage thing McDonald's, and the fact that this week as they announced their new business model with the self-ordering kiosks, and their stock price went up to $150 or $55, I think, over that, it has a lot to say about the future of the fast food job market.
Well, once they perfect the burger making robot, which I think that's actually come a long way, you won't have any human interaction at all.
Well, you know,
at your local McDonald's.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jack in the Box here in Cincinnati uses the people. There's like three people. Anytime I've ever been in the store, there's only ever been three people working. There's a person who like wipes down the tables and, you know, cleans up if people don't clean up after themselves. And there's a person who's cooking in the back, and there's a person who delivers the food from the back to the front. And then you order through these kiosks. The best thing about the kiosks is if, like, my kids are the worst on this. You know, it used to be when I was little, you go to McDonald's, you got what you got. You ordered a hamburger, it came with mustard, ketchup, and onions, and a pickle. Today, you know, you go through the drive-thru line, and it's like, I want this with no sauce, and I want this on the side, and self-ordering kiosks, they make sure that all of that's right. Nobody mishears somebody. You know, nobody is...
Last week, I stopped at a McDonald's literally on my way. I got out of the theater. I went to go see Wonder Woman. Got out. Went to the McDonald's and rushed over to rehearsal, and I actually went in because I wanted to make sure that, yeah, you know, because I'm very particular. I ordered 2 plain cheeseburgers with mayo only. What did I get?
You got 2 cheeseburgers.
I got 2 cheeseburgers, pickle, mustard, relish, pickles. I think they added crap that
Big Mac sauce.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I finally get over to the rehearsal, and I open the bag, and I'm like, I cannot eat this.
Yeah.
So then I was stuck with crappy fries and a Coke. And that was my dinner. The more you can eliminate the nonsense, I think the better, and that's where technology comes in.
Yeah.
That's really what the whole thing's about.
Well, the thing is regardless of whether we want it to, technology is going to take over these spaces. You know, McDonald's makes their money on volume business. Look at the dollar menu. You know, they're making pennies on those products, and that's the products they sell the most. That's going to be how they make more profit margin without changing prices. Changing the minimum wage on Joe jobs, unskilled labor jobs that are everybody, no, there's nobody on any political side who doesn't argue that working at McDonald's is a starter job, or working at Wendy's is a starter. It's a job to learn skills to work at. The problem is for the last 8 years with the previous administration, the only job growth that there was in starter jobs. There was not job growth in jobs where you needed high-tech workers, where you needed construction, where you needed skilled trades. That was all downplayed.
But the problem with that is that now that we're turning those jobs over to robots,
increases the unemployment rate because you don't have skilled workers.
The other thing about the $15 minimum wage is that nobody is really talking about how that affects jobs that are already making $15 an hour.
Yeah.
Because now those jobs are going to have to, they're going to have to pay those people a little bit more.
Yeah.
And so the net effect of that is increased prices, inflation everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there was a study out of Seattle that I saw today that says that a rapid increase in the minimum wage actually puts less money in the pocket of the people that are supposed to benefit from that anyway.
Absolutely. Because, well, the whole idea is it causes inflation across the board. Well, if you're making $15 an hour, they always use the gallon of milk. You know, so if a gallon of milk costs $1.99 and you're making $6.75 an hour, you're only spending a third of an hour's wage to buy a gallon of milk. But you move everything up, you're making $15 an hour as minimum wage, gallon of milk increases because they now have to pay their minimum wage workers more, and it just moves up the supply chain, and now a gallon of milk costs $15 a gallon. So now I'm spending an hour's work, you know, one whole hour for, I mean, to sit down and do the math and then watch the actual, the problem is we can make up these models and they're theoretical. If I plug in the right number in the right spot, I can show you how, well, this makes perfect sense. But it doesn't work that way. And it's not just, you know, in our own failed experiments here in the States. We've been watching this happen in Canada and Europe. And I mean, there's a reason Great Britain is leaving Brexit. And nobody... Brexit is huge. And even though Theresa May lost quite a few seats on her
gamble.
Yeah, it's not like the Labour Party is going back and going, no, we're stopping Brexit. They're like, we're going. We want to get rid. We want out of this. And you know, I'm telling you, Germany is next. They're gonna Angela Merkel is gonna go, and somebody much, I won't say progressive because that's not the right word, but somebody who has a better view of the future and understanding of economics and everything is going to come in, and they're going to go, you know what? We're the only country propping up the EU at this point.
The problem with Germany is they have a huge influx of Islamic population that aren't really German.
Very true.
And, well, I mean, really, UK is kind of the same boat. I think we're finally starting to see the UK fight back a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not so sure Germany's going to do that.
You know, I would say France, you're never going to see them do it, and a bunch of rifle droppers anyway. But I think it'll happen in Germany. They're having too many other social issues on that alone, but I think economically, when you look at what's left of the European Union, what are the economic powerhouses left in the European Union? Well, Great Britain was one of them. It's gone. And so France is not an economic powerhouse. Spain is bankrupt. Greece is bankrupt. You're not going to get anything out of Sweden. You know, the little countries, they're not bankrupt, but the way they organized themselves to be part of the union, they protected themselves fairly well. They're not going to be ponying up any extra money. Who is going to be doing it? It would be Germany, because they're the only nation left that has at least a relatively large economic industrial output.
Plus, I think it's very entertaining to see President Trump tell European powers it's time to pony up.
Exactly. And what killed me is they laughed and sniggered about it. And I'm sitting here going, well, you know, when we don't pay anymore, good luck on defending your own borders.
And I say the same thing about the UN.
Well,
because I don't see we're getting anything out of the UN.
No, I don't think we are either. I actually think we more than likely, you know, what we've both been saying, which is get the U.S. out of the U.N. and the U.N. out of the U.S., I think that's going to happen. It may not happen next year or 6 months from now, but I bet you it happens within the next 10 to 20 years. I also think that more than likely we will have a better trade agreement than the ones that have been negotiated by previous administrations. And it will more than likely be not only a trade agreement, but it will be NATO's replacement, which will be involve quite a few fewer countries and probably only revolve around the United States, Canada, and Great Britain.
Well, I don't really have a problem with that, because really, that's the only, and Israel, and that's really the only three countries I can count on.
Exactly.
France, you can't count on France for anything, except waving a white flag and being a pain in the butt. That's it.
Yeah.
Germany, I think Germany's a lost cause. I mean, I think it's too late for them to turn the tide on the Islamic refugee problem that they're having.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason Great Britain is not in as bad a shape as Germany was before their Brexit vote, it's because there's water that separated them from continental Europe.
Oh, absolutely. Who'd ever thought that water was still a legitimate boundary to be contended with?
Yeah.
To a certain extent, I think that's kind of why we're still in our own little bubble. We've seen some things in this country, but we haven't seen what they're seeing in Europe and Israel.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But so, how does technology fix any of that?
It doesn't in some respects. In some respects, like from an economic perspective, it's going to widen the one thing that the liberals don't want is that widening of the economic gap between the rich and the poor. Everything they do widens that gap more so, and it's just enabled by technology. Because when you can't rely on labor, you automate. And when you automate, it eliminates the labor. You know? I don't know. But, you know, there's so many other issues with labor. And I hear it all the time from people. I don't experience it because I don't think my kids and the people, you know, our social economic group that feel this way. But I think there is this huge malaise against hard work in a large portion of our young population. And I think it was, you know, part of it's, you know, overparenting, helicopter parents, you know, the whole idea of nobody wins, everybody gets a trophy, you know,
now here's a point that Mike Rowe makes that I think is also very valid to the subject at hand, and that's we're not celebrating the trade schools.
No, you're absolutely
right.
It's
got to be a 4-year degree or you're an idiot. You know, and that whole mentality is what's crushing American innovation.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, now I will say there's a flip side of that, too. There are other skilled trades that the skilled trade unions in the United States said aren't skilled trades. And so they pushed kids who really were skilled trades, particularly when it comes to computers and electronics and stuff. You know, your plumbers, weemers, carpenters, you know, the apprenticeship programs, they don't want kids who are doing it was only in specialized industries like the auto industry where you were seeing robotics, people who were skilled trades in robotics and things like that. But that's because it was necessary. Whereas other places around the world, you know, what's considered a skilled trade is much, much, much greater. The other problem is our American education system. How do I want to say this? Because it is the fault of both parties in this respect, both major parties. But that dream of the four-year degree being the epitome of what everything is, they drove the education system to, you know, how they get funding is how many kids they send to college and how high their ACT scores are and everything else. And they used the vocational training programs, you know, the career centers and things, to send the kids who they knew would cut it, you know, academically to help them get these high scores. Now, that's slowly turning itself around. I've been more impressed with what the career centers have done, but I mean, it's still 20, 30 years away, and you know, there's still that iffy edge of whether they will ever get the respect they need. You know, and even kids who go to the trades, the career centers today, and you know, and are actually learning trades, most of them go to college because the only way to get a job, even in a skilled trade, is to have at least a 2-year degree.
Which again, I think goes back to, we have gotten ourselves to the point where we're celebrating education for the sake of education, even though what we're learning is
It goes back to what I said before, and probably 3 or 4, if not long, many other podcasts before this, where we're pumping out degree programs, and it's not even that. We have too many colleges who are offering degree programs that have a very limited job. And I will use it because we both have degrees in music. The music, there's no reason for more than one school in every state to offer a music program, frankly.
I would say 2 just for the sake of competition between the 2 schools. But
I mean, you know, you can't be pumping out a ton of music education majors. There aren't those jobs. You can't be pumping out music performance majors and other things. Because at the end of the day, a lot of the best musicians I know, they do something else, and music is their passion. And most of the time, you send something that is an art, it is not, and you codify it into a degree program, it takes all the passion out of it. And people come out of it lackadaisical. We wonder why, you know, there's no motivation in these kids. It's because they look at it and they go, there's no jobs for me to do. I have this degree and I worked hard and I did great in my school and it was a competitive school. And I mean, I know Juilliard majors who were at the top of their game at Juilliard. They're like, you know, playing coffee shops. How much did you pay for that degree?
How much are you still paying for that degree?
You know, and they're competing against people who don't have to have degrees, you know, for the same jobs. You know, that's not it. As much as I love the liberal arts education and you know, we talk about, you know, art and there's a lot of jobs like this. How many business majors should we be pushing out? You know, the only good thing is a business degree, like a liberal arts degree, at least if you get one, you kind of are a jack of all trades. You can go and do a lot of different things with it. But as the job market contracts, that you start limiting, you know, those opportunities because there's that employers no longer have to look outside of the career field that they're, you know, to find qualified candidates. The other thing that has changed in industry too is a lot, particularly in the tech industry, is the tech industry for a long time would take kids out of college, math majors, music majors, you know, things that were math related. And then they would train them to be programmers or whatever they needed. And those programs are going away too because we now have a glut, or, you know, as they become more streamlined, you know, and we're not short of computer science majors anymore, you know. Plus, all the H-1B visas they keep bringing in because those guys can pay them less and they keep them as temporary employees and then they send them back. And then all of that money leaves our country. I mean, I don't know. It's a quagmire. And I'm not going to run for office to solve it. I'm just going to complain about it.
I'm guy behind the guy behind the guy, so.
So, well, I think that wraps up our show today. We want to hear from you, so please send us feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.